Terry O'Reilly. Long before he had a radio show, Terry was an award-winning writer at Canada's top advertising agencies, creating campaigns for top brands such as Labatt, Bell, Nissan, and Pepsi USA, and created a campaign for a group of nuns, which we may or may not get into. In 1990, Terry co-founded Pirate Radio and Television with 8 recording studios in Toronto and New York City. In 2005, he became the host of the CBC One WBEZ Chicago radio show Under the Influence, with over 1 million listeners a week. His podcast has been downloaded over 40 million times. He has been given a Lifetime Achievement Award by the Advertising Design Club of Canada and has been granted honorary degrees from 3 Canadian universities. Terry has written 3 books. The latest is My Best Mistake, about people who made catastrophic career decisions, but it ended up being the best thing that ever happened to them. The book was launched in October. He has a wonderful wife and 3 lovely daughters who like some of his work. Welcome, Terry, to the Bibliophile.
Well, it's great to be here, Nigel. Thank you.
So what work do they like?
Well, you know, when you are the family of an ad man, you get a lot of pitches across the dining room table. So I was always bringing home ideas or working on ideas at home, thinking, hey, what do you think about this? So I get a lot of opinions from my the 4 women in my life.
Right. You're lucky, you know. You are lucky to be surrounded by 4 women.
I know I am. I am very lucky.
Well, we're here to talk about how to market a book. I'm just going to set out a few of the major questions that would be asked before one heads out on that journey. First of all, who's going to want to read this book? Would you say that's the right question to ask to start with?
I think so, because like a good advertisement, you need to know who you're talking to because you want to be relevant. So I think that's a good starting point. Not that I'd write a book saying I'm going to think of my audience first, then think of the book. I would think of the book idea and then think who would want to read this. And then that would inform the writing as I went.
Yeah, do you think more and more, though, that the big publishing houses are asking that question first and then trying to get someone to write the book?
Yeah, I do think. I mean, they're marketers, too. So I think, you know, that there are times when they're going to identify an audience opportunity and then maybe find an author or commission a book that would, you know, be aimed at that market. So, yeah, I think that happens.
And I guess really, the book that comes directly from the loins of the author, it's obviously more genuine, it's more heartfelt.
Yeah, I think so too. I think that would be the best scenario for a writer, is you just really are, you have an idea, you have a passion for it, and you write that book. You know, we can get into how you have to pitch that book if you're not going to self-publish and hope that a publisher likes the idea. They'll immediately evaluate the idea, not just on its own merits, but if they in fact think there is an audience for that book before they put all their resources, money, and distribution and marketing behind it.
Right. The next question then is, once you've figured out, you know, who you want to read the book, then how do you get to these readers and what messages you're going to put in front of them to try and persuade them to buy it?
Yeah, and that's the toughest part of marketing a book, is where are your readers? Where are they? And then how do you get to them? The days of finding one big mass audience in one place, you know, they back in the 60s, Nigel, you remember, if you bought the Ed Sullivan Show and Bonanza, if you put a TV commercial on those two programs on Sunday night, you would reach 80% of the North American market. You just can't find, I mean, Super Bowl aside, you can't find that one audience in one place anymore. So now your marketing has to be kind of an all-terrain vehicle. You've got to figure out, are they on Twitter and where are they? Are they on Instagram, Facebook? Is there a group out there online that I can contact? I mean, you've got to really sit down and think about the various ways you can reach. I mean, the beauty of all that is social media is a wonderful thing for authors now. Because prior to that, you would have had to buy mass media, which is very expensive.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, the idea of advertising on the Super Bowl is kind of ridiculous, isn't it? Because it's hugely, hugely expensive. You're never going to make any money back on that kind of
advertising. No. TV is incredibly effective. It's just not incredibly efficient. It's too broad a spectrum. I mean, with cable channels and specialty shows, I mean, if you were writing a cookbook, there's the Food Channel. So that's right up your alley. But if you're not being that specific with it, it's tougher to find your audience on TV. But and what author can afford television commercials anyway?
Yes, yes. Well, again, every book is unique, isn't it? So you know, you have to start from scratch every time.
Yeah.
Now, your book, the book that I really got a lot out of and enjoyed, was The Age of Persuasion. That's about 10 years old now, though, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Those numbers that I read out to start with are huge in terms of the listenership of your radio program and podcast. So I guess the trick following your lead is just to set up a popular podcast, and then you've got an automatic audience.
Well, there's no doubt about it. I mean, I think that one of the key aspects for anyone that wants to put out a book or whatever it might be is to have a platform. If you have a platform, then you've got a built-in audience, you've got a community, you've got a way of talking to whatever your, you know, if you want to call them fans or whatever. So I was very fortunate in that I had a CBC radio show, a national show. We were really pioneering podcasts back then.
Yes.
We've been podcasting for 11 years. There were very few podcasts in the early days when we were podcasting. So even that built us an even bigger audience, because I really do believe that radio listeners and podcast listeners are two different tribes.
Right.
So podcasts really let us find an even bigger audience in some regards. But a platform is very important. If one can find a platform, you're starting the race halfway down the track.
By platform, maybe you could define that a bit more closely.
Well, in my case, the platform would be having a radio show. So there is a base from which you are operating that has some kind of profile out in the marketplace. So if you have a podcast and you have listenership, that's your platform. You have a radio show, that's your platform. If you had an active YouTube channel, that could be your platform. Whatever it is a base that gives you a profile out in the marketplace already, that there is a built-in audience for you for one thing that you can then introduce a second aspect to.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, well, any kind of company that already has a sort of a network of contacts, they sell one thing to, and oh, wait a minute, there's this other interesting product line. All I have to do is give it to my reps and they can introduce it to an existing clientele that they've got relationships with.
Yeah. If your audience is interested in you, they will be open to hearing another aspect from you. You know, celebrities are a great example of that. You may love watching an actress in a movie, and if she puts out a autobiography, you think, oh, you know what? I'm going to read that because I think she's an interesting person.
Yeah. Most celebrities aren't that interesting, though. Yeah, I think serious authors, though, typically aren't necessarily wanting to spend their time developing a fan base.
You know, this is a very interesting question we could spend a lot of time on that. There's a couple of things I want to say about that. First of all, authors really, if you really want to be a successful author, besides the quality of your writing, you have to come to terms with being a marketer. You have to actively market your book, because a publisher only gives you about a month. They go hard on your book for about a month and then they move on to the next book. So it's a very short window to launch your book. So from that point on, from the 31st day on, you've got to pick up the slack. So as an author, you have to sit down and think, okay, I have to give interviews. I have to search out interviews. I have to put out tweets. I have to post on Facebook. You have to get willing to do all of that. And I'll also say this, Nigel, there is a Canadian aspect that gets in the way of promotion, that it feels very un-Canadian to just be so upfront about yourself, to promote yourself. And I think a lot of Canadians have trouble with that, unlike Americans, which will, you know, have no problem with self-promotion.
Yeah. I should say they don't have to do any of that. If they want to make money and put noodles on the table, they have to do that.
Well, yes. But also, you want to have your book read. I mean, you don't want to just send it to family and friends and that be the end of a two-year journey that you've been on. I think you really want people to read.
That's certainly a good point. One of the key motivations behind writing anything is you want to connect with other people and you want to share what you have to say. And authors do have an important story to tell, don't they?
Without question. I'm such a big reader, Nigel. I must own, I mean, I have an office, a little, what I call the writing shed outside of our home, which was an old tool shed, 100-year-old tool shed that was leaning sideways and about to fall down in the next wind. So we rebuilt that to be a little writing shed for me. I have a wood stove out there and I have a big bookcase out there. I must have, you know, 500 or 600 books out there just on marketing.
That's great.
And then I have hundreds of books behind me and in other parts of our house. So I'm a big, big book reader. So the knowledge I gain from books and this sheer enjoyment, I've always got 5 books on the go at any given time. Always, always, always. Some of them are, you know, books I'm reading just for the sheer enjoyment of it. And the other half of them are, I'm constantly doing research for the radio show. So books are a big part of my life.
Well, I'm very happy to hear that. Books are a way to read. And in fact, I should mention that your book, The Age of Persuasion, really reflects that. It shows that you've done a lot of reading in the field. And as a result, there's lots of interesting little ideas and tidbits, just interesting stuff in it about the history of advertising.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I am a big research guy. Even our radio show and podcast, the amount of research, Nigel, that goes into that 27-minute show is quite remarkable. Depending on the theme of that particular episode, I will do initial research on that theme. Then I'll dispatch a researcher. I'll assign one of our researchers to the show. We'll split the researching in half. Like, it'll take us, between the two of us, between 30 and 40 hours of research for the 27-minute show. And I'll get back from the researcher well over 100 pages of research, and I'll probably have half that as well. So it's 150 pages of research that I have to read and absorb before even starting to write the first word of an episode.
And it's a joy to learn, isn't it?
It is a joy to learn. None of that is onerous. Even when I'm on holiday, I'll be reading a marketing book, and my wife, Debbie, so funny, she'll go, "Don't you want to take a break from that stuff?" And I think,
Yeah, I mean, learning is living.
Learning is living.
Okay, I want to learn from you exactly what I have to do to get readers for my book. What do I have to do?
Well, social media, let's start there. You want to make use of Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. And each of those social media channels requires a different kind of tone. And handle it differently. Twitter is very, you know, it's 200 and whatever it is, 70 characters, and it's quick hits. You can add links, et cetera, but it's a quick thing. Instagram is more visually oriented. Facebook is more about creating a community. So you're not putting the same thing in each channel. You're creating something specifically for the strengths of that channel. So you've got social media there.
Let's look at your book then, The Age of Persuasion. What did you do for each one of those platforms?
I have to think back now, 10 years ago. There wasn't much social media back then, by the way.
No. Maybe a better example is your current book.
Yeah. And the one previous to that also, This I Know, I did a lot of things. So on Twitter, I would give little pieces of trivia and tidbits as a teaser to the show, and then a link to either the website page I had developed for the book or a link to buy it on at a bookstore. On Instagram, we created graphics where it looked like it was an open book, and then there would just be one single line across both pages from the book that would be intriguing. and we would put those out, you know, drip those out on Instagram. Facebook, I would put big chunks of the book out there, like just take a, you know, a couple of paragraphs and put them out on Facebook. On my website, I gave the first chapter away for free as a as a downloadable PDF. And okay. I also gave the first audio chapter free on my website that you could download. Because I knew that, or I believed anyway, that if somebody got a taste of the book, of the first chapter, that there was a high chance that I could persuade them to want to read the whole book. Another thing that we did, especially with my second book, which was a marketing book, I reached out to bloggers. So it's quite easy to find, for example, marketing bloggers, people who blog on marketing all the time. So I really, you know, made a study of who the most prominent bloggers were. Then I reached out to them saying, I've got this new book. It's about this. If you're open for an interview, I'm happy to do it. And I got a lot of interviews from bloggers, because remember that bloggers and podcasters now have time to fill and they have deadlines and they're always looking for interviewees or subject matter. So when you give them a great little, you know, you just don't want to say, hi, my name's Terry and I've got a new book. You say, hi, my name's Terry and I've got a new book, but here's why it's interesting. And here's why it might interest your readers or your listeners. And then you give them an angle and you will get an amazing response. Because discoverability is the key in podcasting and in writing, is that people have to know it's out there to want to have it.
Right. Well, and the same holds for the book itself, obviously, too. It's great to have written a fantastic book that that will sell itself once people actually open up the pages and read it. But you have to get them to that point, don't you?
Yeah, because there's people have so many choices in everything. In podcasting, there's 2 million podcasts on iTunes right now. Not episodes, podcasts. Right. And how many books are written in the course of a year? It's extraordinary. You know, how many pieces of music are there put out? Like the choice people have is astounding. And they only have a limited number of books or podcasts they will absorb. You know, the rule in podcasting is people really have only 5 or 6 podcasts that they literally listen to. They may have 20 on their iPhone, but it's only 5 of them they really listen to. And yeah. I think the same with books. I mean, I'm an avid book buyer, but I'm an outlier. Maybe most people only buy 3 books a year or 4 books a year. How do you get on that little list?
Yeah, well, and again, speaking about knowing the reader, your book is not going to be of interest to everyone, obviously.
No.
It's a question of fine-tuning where you send your message, which is what you've talked about. Now, there's a message to booksellers because they in turn sell your book, and then there's a message for the book buyer, right? Did you look at that at all?
Yeah. I did more of that with my second book than in my current book, in that, like, if I'm walking by a bookstore, I mean, the pandemic's changed everything, right, Nigel? But in pre-pandemic times, and I was doing a lot of traveling because I do a lot of speaking across the country. So if I was in a new town, if I was in Edmonton giving a talk, I'd go out for a walk. I'd go downtown and I'd see a bookstore and I'd pop in and I'd say to the bookseller, my name's Terry. You've got one of my books here. I'm happy to sign them if you'd like.
I mean, that's good. Yeah.
They always love that. So I do that even in airport bookstores. I'll do
sure.
I had bookmarks made of my second book, and I would always drop a handful of them off at the counter of the bookstores I passed, and they love those too. They just something else to give their customers, right?
Yes.
And it was
always
information about the book on the bookmark.
Yes. Well, in fact, what you're talking about, and you mentioned this with the podcasts as well, the podcasters and the bloggers, you are giving them something for them to give to their listeners and customers.
Right. And here's a little secret that I learned. When you sign a book, it can't be returned.
Yeah, that's right.
So you want to get into as many bookstores as possible and sign those books. They can't return them to the publisher.
Yeah, which is kind of a crazy part of the whole book publishing business, isn't it? There aren't too many businesses that will accept returns in the way that publishers do.
No, I know. And the other thing I want to add too is, speaking about platforms a few minutes ago,
Yeah.
I give keynote talks across the country. That's another platform I have where I'm standing in front of, you know, a marketing conference, probably between 300 and 400 people. And then I do a big book signing after. I'll get a local bookseller. I'll contact them before I fly to Vancouver or Calgary. And I'll say, will you come out and sell books at my event? And they always happily do. And then I'll give a talk and then I'll sell 60 books at the end of the talk. And the bookseller gets to sell 60 books.
Now, word of mouth, of course, is the most effective way of selling a book. Any advice on how to rev up word of mouth?
Well, social media, again, is a great place to do that. Whenever somebody comments on my book on Twitter or Instagram or wherever, Nigel, I'll always respond. Remember that social media is social. So it's about creating a relationship with your readers or your listeners. If you look at my various accounts, my Under the Influence accounts on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook, look at how much interaction goes on between us, between me and my listeners. It is constant. It is every day. We're talking all the time. I'm not somebody who, you know, just reads my posts. I respond to the posts. And by doing that, but when people get a response from an author or a radio host or whomever it might be, it's a remarkable thing. They feel a connection. And they will become your roving emissaries and evangelists for your work. So I make it a point to respond to everybody. I enjoy it. And in my radio show, Nigel, they give me incredible show ideas. Like they're always saying, hey, Terry, have you thought about doing a show on this? And I'll think, God, that's a great idea. Yeah. So they are a huge part of the creative aspect of our show. And when it comes time to sell a book, I can do that because the rest of the year we're having a great conversation. And then when it's time to sell a book, they're okay with it because we have a relationship. If I only showed up when it came time to sell a book, they would have no interest.
Yeah, and you do emphasize relationships and the importance of them without exploiting that. I mean, relationships are based on trust and the whole idea of co-opting that for commerce is a little bit distasteful. But on the other hand, we've got all sorts of different levels of relationships, don't we?
Yeah, I think, again, tone is everything. I think if you're too overly aggressive or if you're only hitting one bell all the time, which is buy my book, buy my book, buy my book, that's going to be a very short-term strategy. Again, if you have a relationship with people, they're going to be interested in what you have to say. And they'll be interested in a new book and they want to hear about it.
Well, the other thing too, is if you take the time to respond to someone who's giving you some feedback, that's actually a big deal for them, or it would be for many of them. And they may say, they may talk about the very fact that you took the time to respond.
I think that's true of anybody. I'll say even this, this was a big epiphany for us many, many years ago. Most of the email we get about the radio show in particular is positive. I'd say that 97% is just absolutely wonderful, encouraging stuff. The other 3% are people who hate me, hate my voice, that I'm in marketing, hate advertising. They'll send very vile messages to us. But we learned early on that sometimes people who send you the angriest emails are your biggest fans. And that was a big epiphany to me. And what's happened, which we discovered, was, you know, I may have said something on an episode that they just violently disagreed with. And they become so disappointed in you, who they really like and have been a fan of yours for 10 years, that they'll write you this incredibly vile letter. And when that started to happen, my wife, Debbie, who's so smart, said, let's respond with kindness and see what happens. So we responded kindly to some real, and I'll give you an example. Someone who said, you know, dear stupid, comma, you said that, you know, and blah, 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 blah. And then I responded back saying, you know, I don't usually respond to rude letters, but I want to email rude emails, but I want to respond to yours. And here's why I said what I said. And I'd like to hear your thoughts And the next letter I got, email rather, I got back from that person was, I am one of your biggest fans. I never thought you would answer that letter.
Yeah.
And then we really had a nice correspondence. And that became a, really an ongoing thing where if we responded with kindness, I would say 7 out of 10 times we would get a very different letter in return, a very different email in return. So it's always worth responding, even to people who seem to not like your work.
Well, yes. In fact, if they are that emotionally engaged with your work, they're paying attention, aren't they?
Yeah. And I think, I mean, you often hear this said that if you don't ruffle feathers, you're probably invisible. So there's going to be that too.
Yeah. Well, I suppose this good and bad, right?
Public,
P.T. Barnum. Is that true, do you think?
That there's no such thing as bad publicity, that, that philosophy.
Yeah.
I think it's a case-by-case basis on that one, Nigel. I think it's true in some cases. Like, for example, I think last week's episode, I talked about a commercial that got the most complaints in UK history. It was a British commercial, but it also got the highest viewership. So there you are, right?
Yeah. What about, again, that's just looking at your books, what's worked best for you?
I would say social media, because it only takes an investment of time. I mean, you can buy social media ads and promote your ads, but I've never really done that. I've really just put in the elbow grease to post every single day on every single channel. I don't post once a week. I post once a day on Twitter, 2 or 3 times a day. So I make that a big point. And then leveraging all the other opportunities, as I mentioned, going out on talks and then doing book signings. We have merchandise we sell for our radio show, like mugs and t-shirts, et cetera. Whenever we send one of those out, I put a little pre-printed card in there that says, hey, I've got a couple of books out you might also enjoy. So there's like every little opportunity done tastefully, designed beautifully, always, you know, just pushing the peanut further up the hill.
Okay. What about your dust jackets? Did you have any say in those? And I mean, that's really the, you know, the obviously the first audience for those are the actual retailers typically, but these days more and more it's direct to the public. But also there being, you know, you see them on Amazon. People will see them. So can you speak a bit about how you proceeded with that?
I think the book cover is so important. I think a lot of people will even pick up a book in a bookstore based solely on the cover, on the jacket design. I didn't have a lot of say in our first book, the one I co-wrote with Mike Tennant. I didn't have a lot of say in that book cover. Mm-hmm. The second time I did it, I wanted more say in it. And then My Best Mistake, I think, is a fantastic book cover. I just think that design. When my publisher said, let's talk about the book jacket, what are you thinking about My Best Mistake? I said, give me an idea. Don't give me a design. And his designer came back with what I think was just a great idea that just summed up the core of the book, going from my biggest mistake. And then it, you know, everything erased in the middle to say my best mistake. I think that's
brilliant. It's clever. It's very clever. That was the designer that came up with that?
Yeah. And then think about how that extrapolated. So the fact he erased the letters in the middle, ended up coming up with the eraser icon. And notice too that the spine of a book I'm very concerned about too, because a lot of times in bookstores, it's only the spine that someone will see. Yeah. You won't see the whole cover. So
yeah,
I spend a lot of time thinking about the spine. So you'll see the spine of My Best Mistake has the eraser on it. The color of this, I know, was yellow because I wanted it, if it was on a shelf with a bunch of other books, I wanted the spine to bounce. So it had a bright yellow color to it. So jacket design, incredibly important. I would say to authors, insist that you have a big say in your cover design. And you can elbow your way into that, which is what I did. I just said, you know what? Come on, I'm a marketer. I want to have lots of say on this. And then really don't. And then once you've got a cover design, think, okay, how can we make the spine as interesting? Or, you know, you got a very little to work with there, but still very important from a marketing point of view.
Well, design is narrative. if it's working and it's good design, is telling a story, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I guess the story you on your dust jacket you want to tell is, hey, this book is really good. Go and have a look at the first page.
Yeah, I think you want to try. I mean, I think the ideal scenario is if you can sum up the essence of the book with the cover. In other words, the elevator pitch of the book. Let's talk about that for a second. I think every great author should have an elevator pitch for their book.
Yeah.
And by that, I mean, of course, that you can sum up the basic idea of your book in a single sentence. And I think that even is important when you're pitching a publisher, that you go, you know, my book is about, like my pitch for my second book was, this is a book for marketers who don't have an expensive advertising agency on speed dial.
Nice.
That was the pitch because, you know, most marketers at most companies in this country are small to medium. They're the ones that keep the economy going and they don't have advertising agencies. It's only the big brands like Molson and Labatt and, you know, that have the big money. So this book was written for them. My best mistake, the pitch was basically exactly how you described it. I wanted to explore people who made catastrophic career decisions, and it ended up being the very best thing that ever happened to them. Like, not just a sentence. And your cover should reflect that, I think, anyway, in an ideal situation, reflect your elevator pitch.
That greatest mistake angle holds for some of the greatest inventions ever, too.
Oh, for sure. And there's a couple in that book. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I'm thinking of the Petri dish and the milkmaids and Madame Curie, I think it was.
Yes.
Okay. So the dust jacket, I'm a huge, I've done quite a few interviews with designers of dust jackets. It's just such a wonderful a marriage of art and commerce, you know,
it's exactly that, Nigel, art and commerce.
Yeah. Yeah.
We even got, just out of interest, I should have brought one in to show you. We bought erasers and had them printed. And it said, a big mistake or lucky break, ? And then on the other side of the eraser, it said, you know, where the book was available. So we really took the eraser and ran with it as a fun promotional device.
Right. Well, of course, the dust jacket also has text on it.
Yeah.
And I have a copy and I recently read The Art of Persuasion, maybe I could just take the time to read it out and get your comment.
Sure.
So to start with, and this is in a nice orange type lowercase with the age of persuasion in black type uppercase, the first thing you see is, well, the first thing you actually see is a little cow on the inside flap. And then millions of Canadians have tuned into Terry O'Reilly's hugely engaging take on advertising on CBC Radio's award-winning The Age of Persuasion. Now O'Reilly and co-creator and fellow ad man Mike Tennant have packed the funniest bits, the biggest moments, legendary industry anecdotes, and never before revealed behind the ad stories and musings into one fascinating ride of a book.
Yep. So I think that summed up the book written by my publisher, because the inside flaps are usually where the publisher gets to talk about your book.
Well, the author sometimes gets a little nose in there too.
Although I'll say we didn't get our nose in that. That was purely our publisher. But I mean, of course, he showed it to us and we said it looked great. We liked it.
Yeah. Okay. And I'll just continue here then. Now we've got the running shoe because on the cover, it's a lot of white space and a smallish picture of a cow. Remember when cows wore brands and you wore sneakers? And then there's a big sneaker underneath and a lot of white space. So what do you want to do? Did you have a say on that?
Well, not as much as I subsequently had. It's interesting when you're a first-time writer, first-time author, you don't know what the rules are or how much you can push. It was I really had no idea. For example, Nigel, when we got our book notes back from our editor on that book, there were 704 notes because they were numbered. And I thought to myself, good God, really? 704 notes that we have to take up with you? And I remember we sat down for our first meeting with our editor, and her first three notes were terrific. And then the fourth note, I just completely disagreed with. I said, I'm not changing one word of that sentence. And she said, okay, it's your book, moving on. And I thought, oh, okay, this is how this is going to go. So yeah. Then I relaxed, right? And yeah. The same with how much can you push a publisher with your jacket, your cover design. I didn't know how much I could push on book one. I felt privileged that I was even getting a book publisher and getting a book put out. I didn't know how much I should rock the boat. I learned that I really wanted to rock the boat on the second and third book. Like I learned my lessons in the first book, right?
Yes, yes. Oh, that's great. I think the thing about being a writer and working with an editor is damn right you push back. Don't screw with what I've taken years to develop.
That's so true. I mean, that's the first initial feeling you have. But someone then, said to me, another author, when I said, God, I just got 704 notes from my editor. This other person who was also an author said, that's a great sign. That means your editor is really dialed into your book. And I thought, okay, that's another way to look at that.
For sure. That's what went through my mind, too, is you've got a really good editor there who really is paying very, very close. Right. Yeah. Okay, I'm just going to read the second part out here again, because I think it's such an important part of marketing the book. Here we go. Persuasion is a whisper in your ear so faint you barely know it's there. It's the celebrity spokesperson, the anti-ad that's itself an ad, the well-placed product placement, the art of being noticed with purpose, and the craft of guiding your hard-to-reach desires to a lucrative destination. But things don't always go this smoothly. O'Reilly and Tennant take us inside ad company decisions, some good, some not so good, through commercial studios and into some of the most creative minds in the business. They show us what works. Funny is a good place to start. And what doesn't? Sometimes funny, but not in a good way. And then effortlessly connect these findings to our daily lives. And there's more. The authors map the key aha moments in an industry that has evolved from straightforward print ads in the 19th century to the glossy undertakings of the advent of Madison Avenue to our own quickly changing times when TVR, Facebook, and Twitter are leaving many advertisers out in the cold, pawing longingly at the window. The book you now hold is a feast of enlightening ideas and entertaining stories well told. There shouldn't be much persuasion involved in convincing you to buy The Age of Persuasion right now. And there's an asterisk that says, hardcover available only for a limited time only.
Which is so true, because your hardcover is only out for a little bit. It'll be your soft cover. That'll be your long-term. Yeah, so that blurb, that jacket blurb, I think really summed up the book. Because remember that the basic pitch for that book, which was in fact the same pitch for the radio show to CBC, was that we were going to take listeners and readers, we're going to give them a backstage pass to the closed world of big-time advertising. So that was how we pitched the show to CBC back in 2005. We said, we're not academics, we're not pundits, we're not journalists. We're working ad men in the trenches. And advertising is a fascinating business, even though most people think it's annoying and irritating, because it's the study of human nature. And nobody studies human nature like the advertising business. And we have access and we have stories. And we want to take people on a cook's tour of the ad business. And that was really the pitch to CBC, and that was really the pitch to the publisher for that book, which was, we'll tell you the stories behind the greatest campaigns of all time, or the ones that you've known since you were a child, and wait till you hear the stories behind those campaigns.
Well, what I like about it too, and you've just alluded to it, is that advertising has bad PR. Advertising, no one likes it. It's the price you have to pay to watch the TV you want to watch.
Yeah.
And it's a pain in the ass, and don't like being manipulated, and there's all that sort of negative feeling that's brought up. But if you just stand back a minute, and you make this point, it's hugely important to our culture, our civilization. Too important. But the fact is, it's important.
Yeah, it keeps the wheels of commerce going. It keeps people employed. I mean, there's so much bad advertising out there. That's why people hate it. But let me say this. There's a lot of bad books. There's a lot of bad movies. There's a lot of bad music. It's just that you see it so often, as opposed to how many books you read a year. You probably see 3,500 commercial messages a day times 365 days a year. And that's why you're particularly annoyed with advertising, although the good to bad ratio is probably the same as any other medium. But it does keep the wheels of commerce going, and it does have important information so you can make informed choices in the marketplace. And I always celebrate the best of advertising in my show and in my books, the smart stuff, the clever stuff, the honest advertising, just the really smart marketers who just really just try and present their product in a differentiated way in the marketplace. Remember that most marketing is not really, I know this sounds crazy, not really trying to get you to buy something. They're really trying to get you to prefer their brand when you are buying that thing. Like, you know, Ford's not trying to entice you to buy a car. They're trying to entice you to buy a Ford when you're in the market for a car.
That's right. In fact, that's exactly what Stanley Unwin said in his book, The Truth About Publishing. You know, if a book has started to do well, if it's started to sell, the sales are pretty good, then advertising can really help. And now it's not quite a direct parallel.
Yeah.
But the point is that advertising works when there's already a decent amount of word of mouth out there.
Yeah. I mean, it can also launch a product from ground zero, you know, because everything has to have a launch period. There has to be something going on there. I mean, nothing will kill a bad product quicker than good advertising.
That's a great line. Yeah, it's a classic, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if the product is crappy, then good advertising is really going to put it around. Yeah. Just speaking, and we're just winding down here. Just speaking about all the crappy ads that are out there and all the crappy books, one of the things that's most frustrating from a reader's perspective is all of the colossal bullshit that gets peddled about these books, about the fact that they're compelling and they're the greatest thing since Gone with the Wind or whatever it is, you know. It's just so much hyperbole, and it's really annoying the way that expectations are raised.
Yeah.
And then you open the book and it's, I just wonder if you could comment on that specifically about books.
I think that's a very good point. I think the best advertising has no adjectives, because all of those adjectives like compelling and best and better and everything that would have a forest of exclamation marks around it has no value anymore. Those words, like someone once said, and I love the line, they're like the blank tiles in Scrabble. You can use them anywhere and they have absolutely no value. I think the best advertising, and as a writer, I always had that internal rule that how can I write this and make it sound exciting without a single adjective in it? And when you eliminate adjectives from promotion, it's a really tough write, that you really have to use really riveting writing to get people excited rather than riveting adjectives stacked on top of one another. So I'm a big believer in wonderful promotion that is just really great writing. It's not just shameless promotion, if you understand the distinction I'm making between the two. So I think even on, you know, the blurbs on book jackets should take that into account, that you don't have to use all the usual jargon and then just roll up your sleeves and it's a tougher write, but it'll be a better write if you eliminate all the adjectives. And I think it's more meaningful to people when they read something that doesn't feel like a salesman. You can't feel the hand of salesmanship on it. And I think that just will just resonate with people if they don't feel that greased wheel of promotion simmering just below the surface, but rather it's a creative person trying to communicate why their book might be interesting to somebody.
Yeah, it's kind of amusing to go back to the 40s and look at some of T.S. Eliot's blurbs. No adjectives.
Oh, is that right? Interesting.
In today's environment, you'd think they were very, very tepid, but the mere fact that he's paying attention to this book tells you something. But yeah, I just, the problem is, though, so many books aren't good.
I just read a line. I don't know if I can remember it verbatim, Nigel, which is nothing. Let me just think. It's an old line, but I loved it. It's something like this. Nothing can be said about a 25-cent cigar that hasn't already been said about a 5-cent cigar. And what I love about that line is saying all the superlatives that a cheap cigar would use, there's nothing left for an actual expensive cigar to say because it's already been used up by the inferior product.
Right. All the air's been taken.
All the air's been taken. All the adjectives have been owned and subsumed by an inferior product. So in other words, the least quality product will have the most adjectives because it needs it, right?
Yes. Yeah, so beware. Beware of the adjectives.
Beware of the adjectives.
And yet, enthusiasm is what sells a book when it comes to word of mouth, isn't it?
When someone's talking and they're using adjectives, I think that's absolutely fine because it'll be genuine. They're just really being honest about their take on the book. They're just saying, "Guy, I love this book. It was just so interesting and it was so compelling." Like they'll use all those words that a marketer would normally use, but they're not marketing. They're just really being honest about it. So when word of mouth uses adjectives, that's the best scenario. When advertising uses it, that's the least best scenario.
So the trick is to get people to talk enthusiastically about your book. So that's my final question. How do you do that?
Well, I think it's the summation of a lot of what we've talked about. I mean, one thing we haven't talked about is when you elicit blurbs from people. So you'll notice in our first book, we had a lot of blurbs from famous advertising people who we sent early copies to because we wanted people to know that a first book from a first author was actually worth the read. So there's that too. So we got a lot of blurbs from people. I've written a lot of blurbs for fellow authors after I've read the book. I don't automatically, when someone calls me and says, "Will you give me a blurb?" I said, "Send the book.
You've got to
read it." I've provided mostly, there's been two or three books where I said, I can't do it. Either I don't believe in your premise, if it was anti-advertising and I just didn't believe the premise of it or couldn't get behind it, or I just didn't like the book. I just didn't want to waste my credibility on it. So blurbs are another piece of marketing, right?
Blurbs to me are just a reflection of friendship. That's about it.
But to the reader, they might be important. They might just, you know, peruse and say, all these interesting authors or all these interesting people love this book, so maybe I'll give it a chance.
No question of that. And as you say, credibility is the key. Like, I mean, if the New York Times book review has a blurb, I'm more inclined to go with it, yes.
And even in my second book, I convinced David Chilton, the wealthy barber, to do the foreword. He didn't want to do it, by the way. He's against forewords, which is very, because I called him up. I said, "David," because I know David, I said, "would you consider writing the foreword to my book? Because I think he's a great marketer and a great mind. And he's got more enthusiasm than bottled up in one human being than I've ever seen." And he said, it was a huge pause on the other end of the line, which was a bad sign. And then he said, "I don't believe in forewords. Tell me why." And he said, "Because I believe that you want to, they just slow a reader down. A reader wants to get right into the book. They don't want to have to read 4 pages of foreword." I said, "David, I still want you to write it because I think you will be you will set the table for this book." Yeah. And then he actually agreed to do it, which he did, which was interesting. But I had another ulterior motive too. I knew David had a big audience because of Dragon's Den and The Wealthy Barber. So really, beyond the fact he's a great marketer, I wanted to have access to his audience because I thought his audience would like my book, would want the book. The foreword was also a marketing choice for me.
That's a very good piece of advice. And yes, his his Wealthy Barber is probably the all-time best
it is.
Book ever in Canada.
It is I think it's the highest, the biggest selling self-published. Let's remember that part of it. He shared the royalties with no one. Self-published author in Canada. And a great guy, I may add.
Do you live up in Huntsville or not?
He lives in Sarnia.
Oh, does he? Okay.
I think it's Sarnia. Yeah. But I've known David. I did work with him years ago and got to know him. And I just think he's a terrific guy. Just so smart.
Yeah. Well, isn't that what you want when you're reading a book, really? You want to engage with a really smart, intelligent, funny mind. You know, I mean, that's what I do this particular podcast for, really, is to do that. And that's what you want out of a book, too.
So true. So absolutely true. Let me just say this before we part. Every single element of a book needs your attention. The spine, the jacket cover, the inside blurbs, the font, the photographs, like every single bit of it. And then when you go to promote it, how does it look on Twitter? How does it look on Instagram? What are you saying on Facebook? Are you going to the extent of reaching out to bloggers? Are you creating little leave behinds, like a bookmark, or in our case, the little eraser we send out when we send out things to people? If you care, every single little piece of your book and the way that you then communicate your book needs your attention, because every little piece of it, Nigel, is an opportunity.
That's very nicely put. Yeah, it's kind of a reminder that, hey, I've been meaning to open that book or get a look at that book or buy that book.
Yeah. I think it's the same with companies. You'll hear me say it on my radio show often and in my books. Every single touch point, from even what people hear on the phone when they're put on hold at your company, is an opportunity. And it should be a creative opportunity instead of just, one of my biggest complaints is when you call a company and you're put on hold and then you just hear either bad music or you hear some litany of sales talk being thrown at you. My company, Pirate, which when I co-founded in 1990, which I sold in 2012, but we would create, just I'm going off on a tangent here, but we would create special on hold messaging that was funny. We go in our recording studios and we would change it up every month.
Well, and that's such an important part of your message in the age of persuasion is you've got to give something back.
And
you've
got to give something back, even on hold.
Yeah.
You give something back. And people would end up calling our company, Nigel, and say, you know, our receptionist would say, hello, where can I direct the call? And they say, no, just put me on hold. I mean, they just wanted to hear the latest on holdness. It just became this thing with our company. But even my whole point being, everything is an opportunity to be smart, to be creative, to be compelling.
Well, thank you for this opportunity to talk to you. It's been a real pleasure.
And likewise, Nigel, I enjoyed that. Thanks for having me.
And the latest book is?
My Best Mistake. Epic Fails and Silver Linings is the subhead.
Who publishes it?
HarperCollins.
Very good. Well, just finally, did you say everything you wanted to say?
Yeah, I think so. I think we covered quite a spectrum of marketing a book. I don't think there's anything that I have done to market a book that we haven't touched on. I think the biggest and most interesting part is reaching out to the internet community to offer yourself up as an interview, because you'll be surprised at how many interviews you'll land. And it's all about discovery. It's about exposing yourself to an audience. The downside to social media is sometimes you amass an audience, but then you're always talking to the same audience over and over again. So the trick is, how do you get outside your own bubble? And talking to other bloggers or other podcasters, you know, whatever they may be, exposes you to a new audience. We have a podcast company, Nigel, called the Apostrophe Podcast Network. So we have 5 different podcasts on our network. And one of the joys of a network is cross-promotion. So Under the Influence, we'll cross-promote our other podcast called We Regret to Inform You. And that just exposes it to a different audience. So the cross promotion, you just see the audience grow when you're using cross promotion, because you're getting outside your bubble, outside your own, you know, that fan base is great, but you want to grow past that.
Yes. Yes, for sure. That's good advice. Good, Terry.
Okay, Nigel.
Enjoy the trees.
I will. Have a great day.
You bye-bye. Too. Bye-bye.